Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Investing in Youth and the Community Summer Youth Employment Programs and Partnerships conference call. For the duration of the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. For operator assistance, please press star, then zero at any time during the conference. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, May 7th, 2014. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Earl Johnson. Please go ahead, sir.
Greetings. Welcome to the webinar entitled Investing in Youth and the Community, Summer Youth Employment Programs and Partnership. The Department of Health and Human Services, Labor, and Housing and Urban Development, thank you for taking the time to participate today. I'm Earl Johnson, Director of the Office of Family Assistance and the Administration for Children and Families at Health and Human Services Agency. The overall unemployment rate for youth stands at 20.9%, while nearly one-third of black youth and about one-fifth of Latino youth are unemployed. Those numbers mask a reality where youth experiencing housing instability, high school dropout, foster youth, and other at-risk youth face increasing challenges to entering the workforce. Building off of last year's success with the Jobs Plus initiative, we are encouraging state, local, and tribal youth service agencies, workforce development, TANF, and public housing agencies to develop summer job programs for diverse youth, especially those at most risk. As a reference in the recent joint letter issued on April 2nd of this year, human service partnerships are encouraged to create or expand opportunities for low-income youth by allocating TANF resources to summer youth employment programs and supportive services such as job shadowing and mentoring. Additionally, we encourage cooperation with community action agencies to strengthen summer youth employment programs, and we hope that local governments and states will look into assessing available funding for HUD's Community Development Block Grant Program for job training and mentoring programs. Summer youth employment in many cases represents more than just a paycheck. Youth can learn valuable life skills, work skills, and most importantly, gain hope and confidence for their future employment and educational attainment. On behalf of the Office of Family Assistance, I welcome our TANF programs, our workforce development partners, and our HUD partners, and the many other on this webinar who hope to work with as many of you as possible to increase opportunities for our nation's youth. I will now turn it over to Steve McLean of the Peer TA Network.
Thank you, Earl. We would also like to welcome everyone and thank you for participating. We would like this to be an interactive webinar, so we have several opportunities for you to include your input. As you can see, to submit questions, you can utilize the chat box in the lower left corner of your screen. Simply type into the text messaging box as seen below and then press send. We will be collecting questions throughout the webinar and we'll present them to the speakers at the close of the webinar during the Q&A segment. We also have the opportunity for you to weigh in with input for each speaker, so look out during the webinar for polls on topics that you would like the speakers to delve into a bit more deeply. At this time, I would like to turn this webinar over to one of our partners, from the Department of Labor, Employment and Training Administration, Jennifer Troke and Jennifer Kemp.
Thanks, Earl. Thanks, Steve. This is Jen Troke from the Department of Labor's Division of Youth Services, and I'm here with Jennifer Kemp. We are also very excited to be here today and very thankful that you've joined. As many of you know, during the Recovery Act days, we worked very closely with our systems to increase summer youth employment enrollments. And one great connection was always there for us, the TANF population. And as Earl noted, with the current low participation rate of youth in the employment world, we here at the department are doing what we can to encourage youth to enter the workforce through summer or year-round employment opportunities. As you know, in many local areas, summer youth employment programs are driven by the mayor's office, and we're very grateful for their leadership. But we know also that our WIA Youth Formula Program can't serve everyone. And so others in the community step in to fill the gap. So we want to also give our thanks to youth providers, employers, foundations, and others. We really look at today's webinar and our joint letter as a way of telling our systems that this is great work, we're promoting it, and we're encouraging you to replicate and adopt the promising practices that you'll hear today on this webinar. Jen.
Hi, this is Jennifer Kemp. I just want to give you a little bit of information about how you can make some of this happen at the local level. During the RA days, there were a lot of opportunities for waivers to exist to make it easier to serve the WIA youth. We often hear that the WIA youth program poses challenges around design a program and performance. So we want you all to know that there still are waivers available that give states and locals the opportunity to focus on this flexibility. California and the Los Angeles area uses a waiver that allows the program to have increased flexibility, not do the rigorous assessment or the individualized service delivery strategies, look at training a little bit differently, and also waive some of the performance requirements. And using that waiver, they recently served 1,700 youth who may have not been served through WIA funds previously. Similarly, Minnesota has taken a slightly different tact, and they're really focusing on teen parents and using the waiver specifically focused on that population. And through that, they have other abilities to leverage resources that they might not have had, and also to waive some of the performance requirements to make it more local to what their area needs. So we wanted to let you all know that those waivers still exist, and that we would encourage you to work with your state workforce investment partners. If you'd like to know more about the waivers, we just look at them. So I'm a visual learner, so phones are not the best for me. I like to see people. Here's where you can go learn more about the Department of Labor's waivers. It's www.doleta.gov/waivers. So, again, we really appreciate all the hard work that folks do at the local level and at the state level to make this happen. Summer youth employment is and particularly important for disadvantaged youth. And I'm going to turn it back to Jen Troak, who's going to give us some more information.
Thanks, Jen. And I am delighted to introduce today Susan Kernan, who's a social and educational entrepreneur with leadership experience in academia, philanthropy, government, and business. She's a professor of social policy and management at the Heller School at Brandeis University, and she's executive director of the Center for Youth and Communities, which is one of the nation's premier evaluation and capacity building centers dedicated to preparing young people for college, work, and life. And I'm told she's been attached to every DOL initiative for a very long time. So, Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, the Jennifers, and also Earl, and for a couple of reasons. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thrilled with the partnership that you all have going. It's absolutely essential because of the urgency of this youth unemployment crisis. And I'm also glad to be here because between all of us on this webinar, enough is known for action, and we must get to it with no more delays. So thank you. Let's see. So I'm the first presenter. Let's see if I can get this right. So the title page is, for me, is Summer Youth Employment, So Much More Than a Job, and you already heard that reflected in the very smart remarks preceding me, and I'm going to tell you why that is and what are the key elements. The purpose, therefore, in this, maybe it's now 12 minutes pitch, will be to provide a snapshot of the Walmart investment. I was asked quite explicitly to report on that, and I will, along with the Brandeis Design for Youth Employability Development Through Summer Jobs. And I just want to add a footnote that while I will talk explicitly about the Walmart investment over the last several years, I will also use a lens of 30 years of experience with youth employment initiatives through the Department of Labor to inform that as well. Secondly, I'll share a few of the highlights that are very inspirational about the impact of and importance of a summer job from this initiative, and then identify some of the challenges related to starting and sustaining a community-wide youth employability system, which is really what I think we're talking about today. So when we started working with Walmart Foundation several years ago, this is how they characterized what they wanted to be about: to foster social change and help people have a better life. And that's a pretty big frame for their investments, not just about a job, but really coupling meaningful work, positive relationships, and a support network with education. And if you do that effectively, we have what is called employability development. Now, this term employability was coined not in 1998, but a little bit before that, within the USDOL network, related to school to work and school to career and so on. It's about employing, educating, and supporting at once. Here, the definition by Hillage and Pollard is: employability depends on the knowledge, skills, and abilities youth possess, and the way they present those assets to employers. This is key. It was key for the Walmart Foundation. It still is. It's not just about what you know, but it's also about what you show. And it was very high on the foundation's agenda when we were designing the initiative. So we regard Walmart Foundation as a national leader in workforce development. During our tenure with them, they have funded jobs, funded training and support for 8,500 young people, vulnerable young adults in 10 communities, with a $13.5 million investment, which between 2011 and 2014 was the largest single investment outside of government in the United States. They also funded Brandeis, my center here, the Center for Youth and Communities, to be their national program office. And that meant that we were funded to do evaluation and documentation along with knowledge development, that is packaging the best practices and lessons learned and disseminating them, and I will talk about that in a moment. So we were the national program office for this initiative. And one of the first things we did was work with we did a scan of who was doing what in the United States relative to employability development. We issued an RFP with a very certain design, some design elements in the form of a logic model for the program and a logic model for systems building and community partnerships. We also then did the re-grants and provided technical assistance. So what you see on the screen before you is the ends of a good logic model, right? Be clear about who you are investing in, who you're serving through this initiative, and what the long-term goal is, the impact. So I want to be careful in defining the for whom, because this was about our nation's vulnerable youth, just as Earl and Jennifer was referring to earlier, at risk of long-term unemployment, including those aged 16 to 22, every sentence here was a discussion, both in and out of school, in foster care, with disabilities, formerly incarcerated, and in violent, risky, and high poverty environments. Today you hear a lot about opportunity youth. You sometimes hear opportunity youth referred to as disconnected youth. I don't use that term. I think the systems are disconnected, not the kids, and that's our work, is to reconnect them. So over the long term here, beginning with a summer program and going year-round, we want enhanced employability of these young people who document their skills and competencies and know how to communicate them to employers. And we're going to do that through working partnerships and a systems approach to youth employability across all sectors. Now, we all know, especially the participants in this call, know that the magic is in the middle. What's the strategy for doing that? And I was asked to talk about the 7 grantees in the last year's cohort, but there were actually 10. And every approach was slightly different. There was flexibility in the middle here, except for a few key elements, and that is it had to be competency-based. There had to be certificates and documentation. Reflection had to be built in. There were work experience was 20 hours a week for at least 6 weeks. It was work-based learning for academic credit, either through community colleges or post-secondary, to encourage young people to return to or continue in school. And supports need to be provided, which included transportation and very important trauma-informed care and social-emotional components and financial literacy and all that stuff that you know to be in a well-designed program. So the magic was in the middle. It was different in the different locations. And here are the 10 sites on the screen before you. I think it's very interesting to point out that besides the geographic diversity, there's incredible differences in size of the communities. And there's also differences in the lead agency status. So, for example, there were among the sites on your screen, four of them were led by mayor's offices, four by nonprofits, and two by WIBs, by the workforce investment groups in the communities. And I wish I could give my talk and pay attention to all these questions popping up, but I'm not able to do that. So if you just bear with me and let me get through this, and then I'll address any questions you have. But in addition to the 10 you see on your screen, we also have 5 case studies in the works that broaden the kind of lead agency yet again by looking at conservation corps and statewide initiatives in some places. And you'll see that not all were in for the whole time. Each time we issued an RFP, and it was on an annual basis, and always, you know, with some worry about is the funding going to come through and so on. So it wasn't seamless by any means. But each time we issued the RFP, the standards were informed by the success of the previous year. So in some way, the standards got higher and higher along with the expectations. So Earl and Jennifer already referred to the kind of the statistics, which are both alarming and encouraging. But this quote from Judith Roden, president of the Rockefeller Foundation, just early this year is a very powerful one about the global crisis. 2014, she says, is shaping up to be the year the world takes action on the global youth unemployment crisis. With our collective energy and actions, 2014 can be the tipping point. Let me say, I hope so. I really hope so. Reducing the youth unemployment rate by 1% adds $75 billion to the global economy, says the CEO of Coca-Cola. And the cost of doing nothing is immense. I'm sure you have the statistics, as I do, right on hand about what that means. But it's very, very expensive not to do this. And as you saw from my earlier numbers with the Walmart investment, it's actually very cost effective. I rarely quote myself, but I find it irresistible at this moment because I think this is the tipping point that Judith was referring to and so many of us talk about. Youth development has taken hold in the last decade for certain and started long before that. Youth development without real work experience is a recipe for failure. Absolutely. One of you mentioned the dignity of a paycheck. I think the Secretary of Labor had mentioned that previously and so on. And so is work experience isolated from education and youth development. So it must go hand in hand. We can actually do more harm than good if we just do the scattershot summer jobs, all hands on deck, and get the kids out there off the street. We've all been to that movie before, and it doesn't work. And as I say, it sets up pretty bad expectations. So summers matter, yes, but summer experience alone is not enough. The Walmart network, the community of practice that you now know exists, is tilting toward year-round connections. So summer is part of the year. You know, just because it's not part of the school year does not mean it's not part of the year. And so brokering those connections more fully. there's lots of information about how that can happen. So the good news is that with high expectations, high support, and these three domains connected, employ, educate, and support, the first bullet point says virtually all of the young people engaged in this, virtually all, gained work maturity, job-related skills, and were more employable, that is, work-ready, as witnessed in competency-based certificates and so on. Many, and that's at least 20%, secured long-term unsubsidized employment upon completion of the subsidized summer work experience. One-third to one-half earned certificates that got them that job and also earned academic credit that either caused them to return to school or stay in school toward a post-secondary degree, which we all know is in high demand now for middle skills jobs. Aspirations were up, and this is borne out in other national research, of course, that for those not planning to finish school or go on for more training or education, a significant number, more than half, changed their minds by the end of the summer. So, in other words, this is a reconnection strategy, reconnecting systems and therefore allowing young people to have the kind of equity of in access, opportunity, and outcomes that they deserve. Researchers in two of our cities, and this is very important, with a third evaluation partner, found summer jobs programs alone reduced violence and increased academic success. Chicago is probably best well known for that. Also happened in other cities to a lesser extent. And I'm going to add three more points to this slide, and that is that this network developed and strengthened hundreds of partnerships across the sectors in these communities. When you add it up, we're talking hundreds, brokered new connections across these three domains, and leveraged more than $10 million in financial and in-kind supports. So all of that rolled up meant that Walmart has, to some extent, witnessed by this call across a new set of partners, helped reignite a national conversation about the importance of youth employment, real work, for real pay. So was it simple? No, it was not simple. For every complex problem, and this is one that we created ourselves after 40 years of divestment from the federal government, that there is a simple answer, and it's usually wrong. I wish I could hear the laughter when I say this in an audience. You can usually, people say, you got that right. So building this community-wide system for employability requires leadership teams. There's no shortcut to this, that have technical, political, and visionary skills. And by technical skills, I mean the frontline people really have to understand how to diagnose different employability levels, assess, instruct, develop the curriculum for work-based learning, academic credit for work experience, broker those arrangements and MOUs and so on. The political skills involve what everybody is, the buzzword these days is collective impact, you know, get the right people around the table and so on, and have the political will be results-oriented and stick with it long enough to make this happen. And visionary skills involves making sure that you agree on the problem, which is the youth employment system needs a lot of attention and work. So the key question that emerges from all this is how can businesses, government, nonprofits, and philanthropy work together to improve the broken pipeline of skilled workers at a time when technology and globalization have brought about many structural changes in the labor market? What is that about? And I'm going to suggest three big things. I love the challenges. You see the word small next to it. That was me trying to edit, telling myself that I should reduce the font size. So I think it's hilarious because the it's a joke. These are huge challenges. But the three lessons for developing this community-wide system is, and this is undersold and understood, and just not attention is not paid to it unless you are deliberate about it. It's essentially a political task. It's not always about the money. It's not about a particular player. It's a political task. There needs to be a leadership team. The success or failure depends on the presence of strong local leaders and local capacity to define the problem, that is, admit that the workforce system is broken in this area, and a common agenda needs to be established with all the key stakeholders, define and negotiate common interests, and you can all find them if you take a systems approach to this, and establish accountability across the institutions. So if someone were to say, well, how can I start a summer youth employment program? I would say, please don't do that. Step back and hold on a minute. Let's look at how we can build this thing that has a future rather than just solve an urgent, immediate problem. And it doesn't take that long to do this. Policymakers from all sectors need to recognize that the major challenges are political and get an outcome-oriented task plan together. The second is most of these things fail. The literature suggests about 80% of community-wide system change efforts fail. So it's very tough in these, and yet we have examples now to point to where it's succeeding. It is never done. It's a full-time job because the climate is constantly changing. So much is beyond the control of the leadership teams and so on. But look to Philadelphia and San Diego and Detroit and so on for fine examples, and we can go into that later if you would like to. Oh, I'm sorry. Go back to the third point, which is there's no one right way. As I say, the magic is in the middle, and all politics is local and personal, and you have to work this out, but there are guideposts that make a huge difference in tipping towards success. And those were some of the elements that I shared with you earlier. But wherever you start, you define the problem together. There are processes that enable you to do that in a democratic way so that you can agree that the strategies reflect the local priorities. And I think that's where the solution will be. Developing a theory of action and a logic model are useful for the team to keep you all honest, to be publicly accountable to your goals, and to facilitate the process going forward with an evaluation or whatever you might want to do. Here are some of the problems. We have a lot of innovative programs in the country, a lot of energy that we can build on. If you look at the moving from through to chart, we want to move away from innovative gap-filling programs and move further to a shared vision and common goal for this. Individual, organizational, and human efforts, ideas, and frameworks move to leveraging those actions in unison, together. Enough with the silos. Let's work together and use a broker or an intermediary as a facilitator. We found that that works much better. Search for most effective program models. Uh-huh. Bring together the collective strengths and skills in your community, and you'll find that they're there. And research will simply validate them for the most part, though there certainly are lessons to draw from Walmart and from other efforts in your network. But, to build this system, you have to be, you have to have a skin as thick as a rhinoceros sometimes, because there will be resistance. I have a colleague here who works in early childhood who says the only person who welcomes change is a wet baby. I think of that every time we're working with people who just say, we've been doing this for a long time and it's good enough. No. There will be competition because you're asking people who have succeeded because they know how to compete to now collaborate. And we all know that is very tough. And you have to refine the language and values and understanding. And you cannot ignore that wherever you are in this country, we still have issues of race and power. And resource allocations that are associated with that and other practices that we want to ameliorate, and to ignore them and pretend they don't exist is not a good idea. And again, lack of political will and control of local decision making. So there are some obvious things that you have to be ready to confront. I'm not going to go over this chart, but I put it out here. Thanks to Open Society Foundation, who did the initial work, and then we've added to it, and we can continue to add to it, a lot of federal resources that are left untapped from a collaborative perspective. that can be used for the Department of Labor, Education, Health and Human Services, Energy, Agriculture, HUD, Justice, and Interior, increasingly so, and so on. So most communities love this chart, and they haven't talked to some of the partners who are on the phone now. They're beginning to. So those are some, and I'd like to leave it there because I know that we have so many more folks to learn from and with. And just say, Tom Friedman, by the way, is a graduate of Brandeis University. This is an old book for him. He seems to put them out every year, 2005, The World is Flat. And he's right. We can ill afford to allow two-thirds of our young people to reach adulthood without all of the resources they need to compete. We can afford even less to allow more than one-fifth of our children to enter adulthood with little or no hope of success. And again, the role of work and healthy youth development has been underestimated lately, and it's time for us to get it back on the table. Thank you very much.
That's great, Susan. And Jennifer and I were laughing very heartily, and we're going to steal all of your quotes. So thank you so much. And I know we have some audience poll questions, so I'm going to read the questions, and I think everybody's going to be able to vote on which one they would like to discuss in more depth. So the first question is, what have you witnessed and learned about business community partnerships for youth employment? What works, what doesn't? The second, from the experiences of the seven grantees funded by the Walmart Foundation, what recommendations would you have for agencies looking to implement a new summer youth employment program? We may know the answer to that one already.
Yeah.
And the third one is, what types of TA have been most beneficial to the seven grantees funded by the Walmart Foundation? So I think we're going to let folks take a vote real quick.
Okay.
So the first question was around business and community partnerships, program implementation was the second question, and the third is what types of TA has been beneficial to grantees. And I'm not able to see the votes, Steve and Susan, so you guys are going to tell us which one you're going to talk about.
I can't see it either, but, well, oh, I see, they're coming in. Mm-hmm. Darn it. TA is not the lead, and I wanted to tell you about the Brandeis Academy, but I'll save that for another time.
Oh, man.
The community of practice is such a great thing. Let me say the business essentials for leading and managing these partnerships, how to get them in and so on. And this comes not only from the Walmart communities, but also from our work with the Hitachi Foundation Global Corporate Citizenship Evaluation work. And it's it might sound simple, but these were the alarms that the business community sent off to us when we were investigating this. The first element is to ensure the match and build trust. That is, there, if you are wanting to engage the business and employer community as employers to offer valuable opportunities, work experiences for our young people, we, you know, they're not all alike, and you should send those who are a good fit with that environment and somewhat prepared, as the Walmart Foundation suggested, to present themselves. So ensuring that kind of a match, and that's coupled with building trust in the work that the partnership is doing, but also building trust in the young people themselves. It was really very interesting, in some ways terrible and shocking to us, to find that one of the number one barriers was that they didn't, that the business community had still holds very, very negative opinions of our most vulnerable young people. And so we need to understand that these kids are not bundles of problems that need to be fixed. They have fallen through the cracks of our own making, and they have all the potential to learn and to become self-sufficient adults. So that's a whole public awareness, matchmaking, building trust essential. The second element, and this again will seem simple, but it is incredibly redundant in the research, that you have to learn the language and culture of the business community, and they need to learn yours. And you need to be patient with that and really and do your homework so that you can speak in public and private sector vernacular together. The third element was framing expectations and the value added for the young person, for the business, and for that is the return on investment, and I would say the return on responsibility, that this is whose kids are these? They are all of ours, and so to demonstrate that return. The fourth element was the importance, and I said this a little bit around learning language, but the business community really wants to take time building up a relationship and understanding everybody's motivation. This is these words out of the business community. What's the motivation here, really? And, of course, we were talking to business people who worked in the community but lived elsewhere and people who lived and worked in the community. We were talking with small businesses, mom-and-pop operations, mom-and-mom and dad operations, and all manner of sizes and scale in the professions and in the retail industry and so on. And lastly, they want an evaluation of this thing, and they told us that again and again. We want to know that this is working. They're very results-oriented, and you know this is now all over the public sector as well. So those were some of the essential elements, as they called them, which I find very encouraging. The some of the examples of making active business decisions which respect, nurture, and strengthen the long-term health and vitality of the community. You have to remember that these partnerships, and as they start out, can be characterized on a continuum from, coexistence to collaborative business community partnerships. There are many steps in between. When you have when you're coexisting, you have mutually exclusive goals and roles. You need to move toward cooperation, toward coordination, and ultimately to collaborative decision-making and so on. They understand that, and they want to locate themselves on that continuum and work toward a just and prosperous society. I'm not making that up. That's actually socially responsible businesses talking.
Susan, thank you so much. That is just excellent. We have thoroughly enjoyed your presentation this afternoon, and we look forward to continuing to work with you into the future for 30 more years. And I'm going to pass it back to Damon.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jennifer and Jennifer. I'm here for Lisa Washington Thomas, who is our branch chief for our self-sufficiency branch here at the Office of Family Assistance, and I'm going to turn it over to Amy Dworsky at Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago. Amy is a senior researcher at Chapin Hall at the University of Chicago. Her research interests include youth aging out of foster care, homeless youth, foster youth who are pregnant and or pregnant, LGBT youth in foster care, and teenage pregnancy prevention. Dr. Dworsky is currently the principal investigator for a study of housing programs for transitioning foster youth, an impact evaluation of a teenage pregnancy prevention program, and an implementation evaluation of training on healthy sexual development for caregivers and caseworkers. She is widely recognized as an expert on pregnant and parenting foster youth and on homelessness among youth who aged out of foster care. Her most recent publications include articles about the implications of health care reform for insurance coverage and receipt of family planning services among current and former foster youth, and about the parenting experiences of runaway and homeless youth. She received her PhD in social welfare from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. I will turn it over to Amy Dworsky, whose presentation will focus on workforce development needs of foster youth of youth in foster care. Amy?
Thank you. Trying to manipulate the slides here. Okay. So you may be wondering why we're talking about youth in foster care in the context of this webinar. And the reason is if you read the joint letter that came out from HHS, DOL, and HUD, there was a paragraph in there that encouraged partnerships between TANF agencies and WEA programs on the one hand and state or local child welfare agencies on the other. And the paragraph talks really about leveraging those partnerships to improve the employment outcomes of youth who are or were in foster care. So I'm going to provide a little bit of background for those of you who are not familiar with the foster care system, and then talk about what we know about the employment outcomes of youth in foster care. So the goal for all children who enter foster care is a permanent home, and that can be achieved by reunification, which means returning children back home to their families, by adoption, or by legal guardianship. However, in some cases, that doesn't happen, and young people remain in foster care until they age out, which happens either at age 18 or 21 years old, depending on which state they live in. For these young people, the transition to adulthood is much more abrupt than it is for their peers. We know from a lot of research on early adulthood that increasingly the transition to adulthood is taking longer. Young people are taking longer to finish college, to get their first job, to leave home. That's not the case for youth aging out of foster care. They are expected either at age 18 or 21 to basically be making it on their own with no financial or emotional support from their parents or other family members. So this next slide shows you the number of young people who aged out of foster care each year over the past decade or so. As you can see, that the numbers peaked about 2007, 2008 at around close to 30,000 young people were aging out of foster care. The numbers have come down gradually since then, and the most recent year for which we have data is 2012, when 23,439 young people aged out. The Chafee Foster Care Independence Program is the primary federal program that provides assistance to states to help prepare young people for this transition to adulthood. And it dates back to 1999. It was created by the Foster Care Independence Act, and it has three target populations: young people who are likely to remain in care until age 18, young people who exit foster care for kinship, guardianship, or adoption on or after their 16th birthday, and then young people who are ages 18 right up until their 21st birthday who have aged out of foster care. And every year, states receive a portion of $140 million appropriation, and that the share that they received is based on the size of their foster care population. States have a lot of flexibility in terms of how this money is spent. If you read the legislation that created the program, there's a lot of discussion about self-sufficiency. The funds can be used for a variety of independent living services, including education, training, and services necessary to obtain employment. So, again, this link to self-sufficiency was featured very prominently in the legislation. Some Chafee funds have to be used to provide aftercare services for that 18 to 21-year-old group. And then states can also use up to 30% of their Chafee funds to pay for room and board for young people who have already aged out. And room and board basically is assistance with housing. One other piece of federal legislation I wanted to mention is the Fostering Connections to Success and Increasing Adoptions Act. This was legislation that was signed into law back in 2008, and it had a number of provisions, but the most important one for our purposes is one that extended eligibility for federally funded foster care until to age 21. So up until that point, states were only able to get reimbursed by the federal government for foster care services provided up until age 18. With this new legislation, they are now able to get reimbursed by the federal government for foster care provided right up until a young person's 21st birthday. It's an optional eligibility, so states don't have to extend foster care to 21, and about 20 states thus far have taken advantage of it. The important piece for our purposes today is that there are certain requirements placed on young people if they are to remain in foster care until age 21. And as you can see, Those requirements are being enrolled in school, being employed, engaging in activities designed to remove barriers to employment, or having a documented medical condition. So two of those are directly related to employment. So what do we know about these young people? First of all, that they're disproportionately youth of color, they come from low-income families, and most of them entered care because they were neglected or abused. Many, if not most, of these young people have a history of trauma, either due to the neglect or abuse they experienced, due to violence they experienced in their communities, due to their unstable living situations. So trauma is a big issue for this population. They're also a very heterogeneous population. It's not a monolithic group. And there are very distinct subpopulations within the foster care system. Young people vary in terms of their age at entry, the types of placements they experience, the amount of placement instability they experience, and the types of services they receive. So there's a lot of variability in that. We know from a number of studies something about the outcomes of these young people. And I'll say at the start that some of these young people make a very successful transition into adulthood. They're employed, they go on to college, they graduate from college, they start families, they're raising children, taking care of their children, forming partnerships, they're doing very well. That said, if you look at on average, and you compare young people aging out of foster care to their peers in the general population, you find that they tend to lag behind their peers in a number of areas. So they're less likely to have a college degree. They're less likely to go to college. They're less likely to have a college degree. They're less likely to be employed. They tend to have lower earnings. Many of them are struggling to become self-sufficient. They have much higher than average rates of public assistance receipt. They report high rates of economic hardships, such as being evicted or having their electricity turned off, not having having food insecurity. And also housing stability is a big problem among this population. For example, my research has looked a lot at homelessness, and we see that these young people are at very high risk of becoming homeless. Their struggles are often exacerbated by a number of other factors. For example, early parenthood. Many of these young people become parents at very early ages when they're not ready to take on that responsibility. Young men in particular have very high rates of criminal justice system involvement. And then finally, you see higher than average rates of mental health problems among this population. So I want to talk about some findings from some research that I was involved in here at Chapin Hall with Mark Courtney, one of my colleagues, for a number of years. The study is Midwest Evaluation of the Adult Functioning of Former Foster Youth. It's a longitudinal study of young people transitioning out of foster care in three states, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Illinois. To be in the study, youth had to have come into care before their 16th birthday. They had to still be in care at age 17, and they had to have been placed in care primarily due to abuse and neglect. These were not young people who came in because of delinquency, although some of them were involved in the juvenile justice system. That wasn't their primary reason for placement. We collected data from these young people at 5 points in time between 2002 and 2011, and we had a response rate of greater than 80% at each of the follow-up waves of data collection. And as you can, this next table just shows you the design, the design and the sample size. So we started with a sample of 732, and then you can see the size of the samples at each of the subsequent waves. So this next slide shows you the percentage of young people who were employed at each point in time that we collected data, broken down by gender. You can see that the employment rates increased somewhat over time, but not consistently. One trend that seems to be apparent is that young women were generally doing better than young men, particularly when you get out to age 26. There's quite a gap there in their employment rates. And I'll say that one of the explanations for that was the very high rate of incarceration among the young men in the sample. When we did our interviews at age 26, somewhere in the neighborhood of 15% of the young men were actually incarcerated. It was a very high percentage, and that really accounted for much of the gap in employment. And then this next slide just shows you educational attainment at age 26. Again, you see this gap between the young men and the young women at all levels of education, both at high school, whether or not they had completed high school, whether they had at least a year of college, and then having a college degree. And as you can see, there's a big gap. You know, many of these young people get into college. They get in the door. They begin, but relatively few of them are actually completing even a two-year degree. And then finally, I just want to talk about some of the big barriers to employment among this population. And sort of as, you know, one issue is many of them don't have a high school diploma or GED. We know that if you look at their reading and math levels, they're very low. We administered a standardized reading assessment as part of our study, and the median reading level was seventh grade. Transportation is a problem for this population, particularly once you get outside major cities. Criminal record, as I mentioned, this is particularly problematic for young men. They have very high rates of criminal justice system involvement. Child care is an issue, as I mentioned. Many of these young people become parents at a very young age, so having child care is critical to their being able to maintain a job. And then finally, mental health and substance use problems. They have much higher rates of problems with mental health and substance use than other young people in the population, and so these can also be barriers to employment. And with that, I will end my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. And just a quick note, we're receiving quite a few questions online, and once we get to the Q&A section at the end, we'll answer as many as we can online, but we'll also ask the presenters to stick around a little bit afterwards, and we can mail out the questions and answers afterwards in another format. So we'll answer as many as we can online. But right now, there's three questions I want to pose to you, Amy, for our individuals on the poll. What has your field research revealed regarding homelessness among foster youth? Does gender play a role in self-sufficiency outcomes for youth aging out of foster care? What does research indicate about the distinct challenges facing male and female youth aging out of foster care and finding and securing employment? What are some important considerations for agencies such as HUD and or TANF looking to partner with child welfare and offering at-risk foster youth employment and career training supports? So we'll wait for individuals to vote, and then, Amy, if we can get you to provide a response.
Sure.
Looks like votes are still coming in, but unless
they're too overwhelming here.
Well, it looks like number three. What are some important considerations for agencies such as HUD and or TANF looking to partner with child welfare and offering at-risk foster youth and in career training support?
Sure. Okay. So as I mentioned in my introductory comments, one of the things we know about this population is that many of the young people have histories of trauma. And we often talk in the child welfare world about providing trauma-informed services, services that take into account that history of trauma. And I have much less experience with either the housing system or the employment systems, but I don't know how much trauma-informed practice has sort of seeped into those systems at this point. So I think that that's one issue would be making sure that the staff people who are working with these young people have had some training in trauma-informed services. Second, one of the things about the foster care system to keep in mind is that in many cases, young people are not given an opportunity to make decisions for themselves. So they're told where to live. There are often many restrictions placed on what they can do. They have limited choices about the services they receive. And I think that this can create a problem once young people get out on their own, that they're just not good at making decisions and thinking these things through. So I think that that's something that these agencies, and particularly employment programs, need to take into account, that young people really need to develop good decision-making and other executive functioning kind of skills. That's just not something they've had an opportunity to do while they're in the foster care system. And then also for programs that are working with youth who are still in foster care, is just to be very cognizant of the amount of instability that these young people experience and to be flexible to deal with that. So young people are often having to change placements. Changing placements often means changing schools. Just a lot of instability in their lives. And so, you need to understand if they're not showing up for their job or for their training sessions to really talk with them about what's going on. It may not be that they're not interested. There just may be other issues going on in their lives at the moment that are just not allowing them to benefit from those programs. So those are the three things I would suggest.
Thanks, Amy. And now I would like to turn it over to Maria Lana Queen from the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Thank you, Damon. Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, I wanted to thank you again for your participation and also your overall investment in young people, particularly those that live in low-income households. From a HUD perspective, we believe in this effort. We believe in the power of young people and their talents, particularly those who live in low-income households. And we have about 3,200 public housing authorities across the country that serve as wonderful foundations for partnerships as well as reaching this particular population. Today we're featuring the Youth Employment Academy at Denver Housing Authority and Amy Banker. Just briefly, Amy is a longtime educator and social change activist. Amy is the senior lead coordinator for Denver Housing Authority's Youth Employment Academy, better known as YEA. YEA is committed to providing underserved and high-risk Denver youth ages 14 to 21 with opportunities to improve their economic situation. Amy leads YEA staff in providing employment, education, career exploration, mentoring, and occupational skills training to youth so that they may reach their employment and education goals. Under her leadership, over the past 7 years, YEA has served over 1,400 youth, with a majority reaching their goals of graduating from high school or earning a GED, going on to college or receiving other occupational certifications and becoming employed. A University of Kansas graduate and Kansas native, Amy has over 15 years' experience working with school and community organizations in programs and projects related to youth, human services, and education. And now I'd like to turn it over to Amy.
Thank you so much. I'm going to try and get on my slide here. Here we go. And I'm really excited to be here. It was interesting hearing some of the previous two speakers because their research really trickles down to what we're doing here at the Youth Employment Academy in Denver. And my perspective is really from the front lines and how do we implement some of these ideas and the information that we get from the research. DHA's had a long history of working with in employment and education with our youth through our resident community services. And that's one of the great things why I love working for this housing authority, because we've had such great leadership that really, really believes in bringing those programs to our residents and providing a healthy community. So we have worked with between private and public organizations, such as we've partnered with the University of Denver Bridge Project to, for instance, the Federal Youth Opportunity Grant way back. And we've been started the YEA program in 2007, where we partnered originally with the City and County of Denver to develop it. And throughout the years, I'll go through this a little bit, what we've been doing, but we eventually, in just last year, became our own 501c3. We've always provided summer programming, typically for youth ages 14 to 21. However, just like Susan said in the first presentation, we really believe that it is not just about summer programming, and we are year-round. So what I'm going to show you is a little bit about our programs that do happen year-round. However, we do a stronger concentration in the summer. And our partnerships, we are building all year-round, and again, trying to make that outcome a long-term sustainable for our youth. What we do, I'm going to go ahead and move to our vision here. So what we want in YEA is to have a stable environment in our communities by empowering our youth with educational and economic opportunities so that they can grow and become positive members of our vibrant living community. We want to serve young adults 14 to 24 in breaking the cycle of generational poverty in Denver communities by gaining personal and economic stability through our education and employment training that we do. I had to put a lot of pictures of our youth in here because that's really why we're all doing it. So since 2007, we've, as Maria said, we've had about 1,800 youth go through our program, although there's always more, and we've really only started to track very specifically and get those evaluations and outcomes over the past year, which is why, for instance, in 2013, some of our outcomes around really focusing on that education, completing high school, their GED, and or going on to college. Also, as Amy was saying about the youth staying in college and that drop, that's something we've definitely seen with all of our youth, and they have it's not just foster care youth. All of our youth are facing different challenges and very similar to what Amy was talking about. However, by being in our program, those who did start college did go in, 90% of them went into their second year. However, we haven't tracked long enough to see what that outcome is going to be as far as an associate's or a bachelor's, although we're starting to see some of that filter through now. We did have 100 youth complete occupational skills training last year, with the majority of that in the summer. Probably about 60 of those were in the summer. We do have a high percentage of completion and earning a national certification, and then with a high percentage going on to get employment or go on to college if it's a career that needs further training. We then... Sorry, it's hard for me to talk and change slides, but I told them I'd do it. anyway, we do our Occupational Skills Academy. So things that we think about in the summer are we want youth to get real work experience, as Susan said, but we also believe in that educational and training program, as she said also. We need all of that. We need – so many of our youth aren't even ready to go into that first work experience. And even though we do job readiness training with all of our youth, we have financial literacy, we do career exploration, we do soft skills, we do relationships and communication, they sometimes need that additional step. So what we feel is we want to do this Occupational Skills Academy first, where they go through this, we gear it. Some of them are geared towards the younger youth and some are to the older youth. They can earn a national certification, and again, I'll go through each of our academies we've been doing. And then they can go on to further post-secondary or actually get employed. And that shows you some of our statistics there. We do academies in customer service, healthcare, advanced manufacturing, and culinary. For instance, our Customer Service Academy, we use a national curriculum for this where they can receive a certification. We have the youth come in and go through this curriculum where they learn entry levels in retail and then can have tours, meet with different retail locations and talk to professionals and do job search at the end and or, as I said, go on to some other form of training. This one is just great for all youth because customer service is so important in every occupation, not just retail. So we really like to see a lot of youth take this academy. We also offer one of our really successful one we've been doing since 2009 is pre-professional occupations in healthcare. We want this to be the first step in healthcare. We had seen so many youth encouraged to through the WEA program, particularly to go straight to get your CNA and become a CNA. What we found was a lot of youth didn't even know what a CNA was and didn't actually like doing that. So this is a chance for youth to come in, see all the career paths with healthcare, go on field trips, talk to health professionals. They do earn certifications in those initial ones in CPR, AED, et cetera, so that they can start to learn about this. And we have so many who come in, whether it's a 14-year-old or a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old, who say, oh, I want to be a pediatrician. And I say, how long do you think that will take? And they say, oh, 2 years. So there's not a lot of realistic expectations around that healthcare. And we also say it's a success if a youth goes through this and they decide they don't want to be in the healthcare occupation. Because, again, as I tell the kids, if you don't like people and you don't want to take care of people, would you want that kind of person taking care of your grandma? So it's about guiding and not just putting a youth in a something they're not interested in, something that they may not learn from, and getting them then geared towards that first work experience that then will lead them on that career path and to a higher outcome in their lives. We just developed advanced manufacturing last summer, and this came through a partnership with the Office of Economic Development in Denver, who came to us because the Advanced Manufacturing Association in Denver had said, we don't have any youth, you know, we don't have any skilled workers. And this, of course, has developed nationwide, but in Denver we have so many manufacturers now, and people don't really know what advanced manufacturing is, and I certainly didn't. And I had to develop some curriculum very quickly for a pilot program that we did, and it has been fantastic. So, again, this is for younger youth to get them interested in this, which can deal with it's not about being on the factory floor anymore. It's about learning software, inputting into CNCs, 3D printing, all kinds of really exciting programs, and or moving up into that engineering field. In all of our academies, we do put together career path projects. These youth have to focus on that, learn about what education they would need, learn about how much it will cost, learn about what the possibilities for employment are after this. We also do our Culinary Academy, which we've been doing for quite a while, and is fabulous. This is such a great academy for a lot of youth, and many of them want to do this as a profession long term. Many of them want to learn this because they need to work while they're doing their post-secondary and or to just get into the workforce quickly. So we have a commercial kitchen. We started out with a small one in one of our other housing developments, and we now have a brand new one that opened up in February 2013 along with a working restaurant. This is so exciting and is just an amazing accomplishment that we're all really proud of. So our youth learn all of these different skills during the academy. First and foremost, of course, food safety and sanitation. As our chef says, the first rule is to not kill somebody with your food. So then they learn their knife skills, recipe reading, measuring techniques. We work on math. We try to incorporate in all of our academies a lot of gains in math skills because, as Amy said, all of our youth are on average very low in their reading and math scores. And most employers have told us that they do want to see youth who have basic skill levels in those areas at least. They then are trained in the culinary kitchen and can help with our catering program that we also run out of there, which is very successful too. They are certified in the ServSafe food safety recognized by National Restaurant Association. And then they're eligible to go on to 160-hour paid work experience at our cafe. And this is where they learn front to house from busing, serving, point of sale, prep cook, line cook, everything. And that goes to our work experiences. So the Culinary Academy, we directly go into our own Osage Cafe, which is perfect because our staff knows we are, as Susan said again, with the employers, making sure the trust is there and understanding that these are our youth and we are doing everything we can to make them successful employees in whatever career and industry they're interested in. In the other fields, then, we work with specific employers, and we are trying to work with all of our youth. Either we look at it in two different ways, youth who need very, very basic beginning job readiness skills, and those who are very specific in their career interest. So if it's and also in unsubsidized placement at the end. So if it's very basic skills, we partner a lot with the Boys and Girls Clubs and place our youth there because they're very supportive, and that can be a way for them to start to learn some of those good skills in showing up on time and communication skills in a supportive environment. Otherwise, in our career, we partner with local businesses. For instance, the picture here is of a young man who worked with one of our architecture firms because he was very interested in that. Because of his connection with this architecture firm, a year later, his supervisor called him, and he was able to get a meeting and presentation by the world-famous architect David Ajay, and he was incredibly excited. And we really want to have meaningful work experiences where they are gaining skills and also, again, as the previous speaker said, hope and belief in themselves that this is something they can do. And another thing I always say to all the youth and to people that we work with, if you don't know about a career, if you don't understand about work, if you've never seen it, you've never experienced it, there's no way you can dream about it. So we are really in the business of making sure they understand what's out there and the opportunities that they have. This is a little more about Osage Cafe and some of the youth working in there. We opened in February 2013, so we're barely a year old. It's been a real learning experience, but as I said, it's just fabulous. It's in our La Alma neighborhood. We really promote healthy food. We're in the process of, there's lots of construction still going on because this whole community is being redeveloped in a very, very amazing way, and we're a cornerstone of that and very excited about it. So if any of you are in Denver, please come by and see us. I'm going to talk a little bit about our partnerships and cross-collaborations because that was one of the things that was mentioned right at the beginning when asking for me to do this. And the thing that I found really important is we started out primarily working with the City and County of Denver's Office of Economic Development Youth Services. That is the fabulous partnership with for us. We do have WIA Youth, but we've also worked with them through their Summer Youth Employment Program, the Mayor's General Funds, and TANF, and really developing those relationships through all of those different departments citywide. And again, I think it was Susan talking about the political piece and making sure that you're working with all the different agencies. We have met with our Denver Human Services and our foster youth and different organizations that work in that political sector, such as Denver Public Schools, so we all know what we're offering, and it's one for referrals, but also in employment and in trainings. In some of our other organizations, as I said, is our DPS. We also work closely with Community College of Denver. Art Street's a nonprofit that we work with. I Have a Dream Foundation. All of these different organizations that we work with help us to make a better program. It's one, sometimes we get an additional mentorship. We're referring youth back and forth. We're sharing resources. And it is so important that you're not just looking at it from the government and political standpoint, but the community. And all of these organizations I'm listing right here are all right in our neighborhoods, too, where we're based out of. Some of our private partnerships, one of the most exciting things was when we did become a nonprofit so that we could start applying for some other funding. So that for those work experiences in the past, we were only able to offer those for our WIA youth. Now we can offer them to any of our youth going through our programs because we're getting other funding, such as from J.P. Morgan Chase, who's primarily working with our Osage Cafe. We also have great partnerships with our local businesses such as Ink Monster, our Red Rocks Production 3D Printing, with our academies, different ones who also employ our youth afterwards, such as Service Systems Associates. So, for instance, our youth who have finished the Culinary Academy, completed their work experience, we then have these other organizations who they immediately can interview with and hopefully get placed. Service Systems Associates works with the zoo primarily and other organizations in town, such as the aquarium and such, with their concessions. And in 1 week, they hired 15 of our youth. So we love them, and they also job coach. And that's the other thing. We have to keep in touch with these youth. We want to follow through with them. We retention as important as anything, and that's probably going to be our biggest struggle. But we're seeing lots of success so far, and really loving that we have these summer programs available for a lot of our youth who are in school, but that we can continue to grow and bring these throughout the year so that we can serve more youth, but also more intensely, and hoping for those long-term results. This is just a little more information. We have a couple of different websites. Go to those. Check them out. One of our challenges is, of course, we don't have our own PR person or or staff to handle a lot of those kind of things, so they're not always have the most exciting updates on them, and we have so many great success stories. So if I had another 20 minutes, I could tell you a million success stories, but the most important thing that I found is with our housing residents and our programs are to find those collaborations, find the people who are dedicated, find the political systems and those agencies who are working with us, and to all work together. So if you have any questions, feel free to email me, of course, and I know we'll have some at the end of this. But thank you so much, and I'm really excited to be a part of this.
Okay. Thank you so much, Amy. At this time, we have a quick poll question time where we'd like the participants, again, to choose a topic of choice. The first question would be, what has been critical for your program in building sustainability? Second one, please describe one of the more challenging but eventually fruitful partnerships your program developed. Third, what type of support service do you believe would be incredibly useful for your youth participants but are not currently offering? So we'll take just a quick minute to get our tally. Okay. Results are coming in. Okay. Yeah, it looks like it's the first question. What has been critical for your program in building sustainability? So, Amy, we're going to pose this to you.
Sure. And, you know, it's actually a really easy one. It was becoming the nonprofit because we wouldn't be able to sustain this if you're just going from one direction, if we were just looking at WIA funding. You have to look at all of those different areas where you can collaborate with other organizations and agencies and bring in funding from all different streams. And it's not easy, and it takes a lot of work, and we have a very small staff. So, you know, it's it's challenging, but it's definitely changed the way we've been able to do things. That's why we're able to open up the Osage Cafe. It's why we're able to move forward and start to grow in a different way. So I'm really excited to see what the next 7 years hold, since I've been here for 7 years, and hope for the best moving forward.
Okay, wonderful. All right, well, thank you very much, Amy. So now I'm going to turn it back over to Damon, who's going to address questions and close.
And like I said earlier, thank you, Marie-Ilana, we have quite a few questions, and we want to be respectful of everyone's time, so we're going to take a couple of questions now, and we're going to ask all of our presenters to answer those questions, and we will send those out through the PRTA network in the coming weeks. The first question is for Jennifer, and Jennifer at DOL. I am on the board of a 501c3 neighborhood group who focuses on beautification, safety, and community. Our neighborhood has received a $950,000 grant over the next 3 years and currently have several partners who have hired around 60 youth to work in their neighborhood and be positive influences on younger children as well. Because we are in a very urban city, we would like to hire someone who is willing and qualified to mentor some youth over the summer in order to beautify our neighborhood. Is this something that will be available through the waiver?
Hi, this is Jennifer. Specifically, what they're describing, the waiver would not connect to it, but I would encourage them to go to americaservicelocator.org and type in their zip code and get connected with the workforce board in their area. And one of the things that we're working on here, and by the end of the summer we'll have available, is all the local youth council contacts in the area as well. So the youth council would also be a good person for them to connect to if they have an active youth council in their area. So first idea is to start with going to americaservicelocator.org and finding your workforce investment board leaders.
And congratulations. That sounds exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jennifer. And Jennifer, and there's a couple of questions that pertain to different resources, so we'll make sure to put the resources that Jennifer just mentioned, and also information about the waivers, also information about the joint letter, and also information about some of the HUD programming on the PRTA email that goes back out. I have a question for Susan Kernan at Brandeis. How did Brandeis make this wonderful connection with the Walmart Foundation?
let's see if I can do that justice. So I think it was in 2010 when Walmart became acquainted with our work that we were doing. We were wrapping up for the Department of Labor, and we were on a speech circuit doing Innovating Under Pressure and just explaining a little bit from our perspective and evaluation how communities were responding to, how do you say, say it for me, Jennifer, ARRA, A-R-R-A, you know, that infusion of funding. And the then president, this is a little bit of a story, the then president of the Walmart Foundation was Margaret McKenna. She was about 4 years into her tenure, which is a long time, as it turns out, at Margaret, as many of you from HHS are well aware, because the next president who came along during our work with Walmart was Sylvia Matthews Burwell, who you know is at HHS now, secretary, having left Walmart to go to OMB. And now there is yet a third. So in the span of time from 2011 to 2014, there have been three presidents of Walmart. So how did we broker the relationship? Before going to Walmart, Margaret McKenna was a civil rights attorney and also president of Lesley University, which is a Boston-based university, and she had been there for 20 years. So when she started creating a portfolio that largely revolved around two things, hunger and nutrition and workforce development, she called us and she said, what would your thinking be if you ruled the world in workforce development, where would you start? We consulted with her for a while, sharing our what we knew about this from our experience over many years with DOL and with philanthropy and so on. And she liked what we wrote and thought it was possible and started a pilot. And in the first round, we were simply documenting the grantee's experience and getting back to her. The results were pretty positive, and then she created with the next president, the National Program Office at Brandeis. So it was the same way you do business with develop relationships with the private sector, right? Build trust, take time, be patient, and be as smart as you can, as quick as you can.
Thanks, Susan. And we have two very quick questions for Amy Dvorsky. How much of that money can be used for the summer program?
I'm not sure what money they're referring to.
Then we will move on to this other question while we try to get some clarity on that actual question. What, for Amy Banker, what methods do you use to collect the data after they finish your program to find out if they graduate from college?
This is for me, Amy Banker?
Amy Banker.
All right. Okay. Yes. So what we do is we track youth for at least a year afterwards, but we also, many of our youth are in for longer. So that's why we don't have, if they've finished college at this point, unless where they fall if they're in, when they come in older. So what we're trying to see is, that's all we've been able to track so far, is that first year after they've started school, if they've gone back that first year in college. So we hope to be able to track longer, but that would be a very long-term study for sure.
Thanks, Amy Banker. Mm-hmm. Amy Dvorsky, I think the question surrounds the annual $140 million appropriation for foster care, for the foster care population. How much of that can be used for summer programming?
So there's really, as I said, the use of TAPE funds is very flexible. States have a lot of discretion with respect to how they use those funds. So there's nothing really specific in the legislation that sets an amount of money that could be used for an employment program. It's really up to the states to decide how they want to distribute those funds across all the various types of services they provide.
Thank you. So on behalf of our partners at the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Department of Labor, I want to thank all of our speakers and all of our participants. Please remember to provide your feedback on this webinar using the survey that will appear in a separate pop-up window when the webinar ends. A transcript and audio recording will be made available shortly on the PeerTA Network website, which is available at www.peerta.acf.hhs.gov. We'd like to hear from you regarding future webinar topics. Please submit your ideas via email to peerta@icfi.com. And please help us to expand our network and reach a greater number of people by directing interested colleagues from your local and state networks and agencies to http://peerta.acf.hhs.gov. Please be sure to register for additional upcoming webinars through the PeerTA Network website. Again, thank you all for your participation. Thanks to all of our speakers and our federal partners. Thanks for attending. Have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.